to allow for a bigger brain. Dr. Yarbeck wasn't working under the constraints that required Davis Weatherby to leave his dog's appearance unchanged. In fact, Yarbeck figured that if her creation was hideous, if it was alien, it'd be an even more effective warrior, because it would serve not only to stalk and kill our enemies, but terrorize them. In spite of the warm, muggy air, Walt Gaines felt a coldness in his belly, as if he had swallowed big chunks of ice. Didn't Yarbeck or anyone else consider the immorality of this, for Christ's sake? Didn't any of them ever read The Island of Dr. Moreau? Lem, you have a goddamn moral obligation to let the public know about this, to blow it wide open. And so do I. No such thing, Lem said. The idea that there's good and evil knowledge. Well, that's strictly a religious point of view. Actions can be either moral or immoral, yes, but knowledge can't be labeled that way. To a scientist, to any educated man or woman, all knowledge is morally neutral. But shit, application of the knowledge in Yarbeck's case wasn't morally neutral. Sitting on one or the other's patio on weekends, drinking Corona, dealing with the weighty problems of the world, they love to talk about this sort of thing. Backyard philosophers, beery sages taking smug pleasure in their wisdom. And sometimes the moral dilemmas they discussed on weekends were those that later arose in the course of their police work. However, Walt could not remember any discussion that had had as urgent a bearing on their work as this one. Applying knowledge is part of the process of learning more, Lem said. The scientist has to apply his discoveries to see where each application leads. Moral responsibility is on the shoulders of those who take the technology out of the lab and use it to immoral ends. Do you believe that bullshit? Lem thought a moment. Yeah, I guess I do. I guess if we held scientists responsible for the bad things that flowed from their work, they'd never go to work in the first place, and there'd be no progress at all. We'd still be living in caves. Walt pulled a clean handkerchief from his pocket and blotted his face, giving himself a moment to think. It wasn't so much the heat and humidity that had gotten to him. It was the thought of Yarbeck's warrior roaming the Orange County hills that made him break out in a sweat. He wanted to go public, warn the unwary world that something new and dangerous was loose upon the earth. But that would be playing into the hands of the new Luddites, who would use Yarbeck's warrior to generate public hysteria in an attempt to bring an end to all recombinant DNA research. Already such research had created strains of corn and wheat that could grow with less water and in poor soil, relieving world hunger. And years ago, they had developed a man-made virus that, as a waste product, produced cheap insulin. If he took word of Yarbeck's monstrosity to the world, he might save a couple of lives in the short run. But he might be playing a role in denying the world the beneficial miracles of recombinant DNA research, which would cost tens of thousands of lives in the long run. Shit, Walt said. It's not a black and white issue, is it? Lem said. That's what makes life interesting. Walt smiled sourly. Right now it's a whole hell of a lot more interesting than I care for. Okay. I can see the wisdom of keeping a lid on this. Besides, if we made it public, you'd have 1,000 half-assed adventurers out there looking for the thing, and they'd end up the victims of it. Or they'd gun down one another. Exactly. But my men could help keep the lid on by joining in the search. Lem told him about the 100 men from Marine Intelligence Units who were still combing the foothills, dressed as civilians, using high-tech tracking gear, and in some cases bloodhounds. I've already got more men online than you could supply. We're already doing as much as can be done. Now, will you do the right thing? Will you stay out of it? Frowning, Walt said, For now, but I want to be kept informed. Lem nodded. All right. And I have more questions. For one thing, why do they call it the outsider? Well, the dog was the first breakthrough, the first of the lab subjects to display unusual intelligence. This one was next. They were the only two successes, the dog and the other. At first, they added capital letters to the way they pronounced it, the other. But in time, it became the outsider, because that seemed to fit better. It was not an improvement on one of God's creations, as was the dog. It was entirely outside of creation, a thing apart, an abomination, though no one actually said as much. And the thing was aware of its status as an outsider, acutely aware.
Why not just call it the baboon?
Because it doesn't really look much of anything like a baboon anymore. Not like anything you've ever seen, except in a nightmare.
Walt did not like the expression on his friend's dark face, in his eyes. He decided not to ask for a better description of the outsider. Perhaps that was something he did not need to know. Instead, he said,
What about the Hudson, Weatherby, and Yarbeck murders? Who's behind all that?
We don't know the man who pulled the trigger, but we know the Soviets hired him. They also killed another Bannadine man who was on vacation in Acapulco.
Walt felt as if he were jolting through one of those invisible barriers again, into an even more complicated world.
Soviets? Were we talking about the Soviets? How'd they get into the act?
We didn't think they knew about the Francis Project, Lem said, but they did. Apparently, they even had a mole inside Bannadine who reported out to them on our progress. When the dog and subsequently the outsider escaped, the mole informed the Soviets, and evidently the Soviets decided to take advantage of the chaos and do us even more damage. They killed every project leader, Yarbeck and Weatherby and Haynes, plus Hudson, who had once been a project leader but no longer worked at Bannadine. We think they did this for two reasons. First, to bring the Francis Project to a halt. Second, to make it harder for us to track down the outsider.
How'd that make it harder?
Lem slumped in his seat, as if in talking of the crisis, he was more clearly aware of the burden on his shoulders.
By eliminating Hudson, Haynes, and especially Weatherby and Yarbeck, the Soviets cut us off from the people who would have the best idea how the outsider and the dog think, the people best able to figure out where those animals might go, and how they might be recaptured.
Have you actually pinned it on the Soviets?
Lem sighed. Not entirely. I'm focused primarily on recovering the dog and the outsider. So we have another entire task force trying to track down the Soviet agents behind the murders, arson, and data hijacking. Unfortunately, the Soviets seem to have used freelance hitmen outside of their own network, so we have no idea where to look for the triggermen. That side of the investigation is pretty much stalled.
And the fire at Bannadine a day or so later?
Walt asked. Definitely arson. Another Soviet action. It destroyed all the paper and electronic files on the Francis Project. There were backup computer disks at another location, of course, but data on them has somehow been erased.
The Soviets again?
We think so. The leaders of the Francis Project and all their files have been wiped out, leaving us in the dark when it comes to trying to figure how either the dog or the outsider might think, where they might go, how they might be tricked into captivity.
Walt shook his head.
Never thought I'd be on the side of the Russians, but putting a stop to this project seems like a good idea.
They're far from innocent. From what I hear, they got a similar project underway at laboratories in the Ukraine. I wouldn't doubt we're working diligently to destroy their files and people the way they've destroyed ours. Anyway, the Soviets would like nothing better than for the outsider to run wild in some nice, peaceable suburb, gutting housewives and chewing the heads off little kids. Because if that happens a couple of times, well, then the whole thing's going to blow up in our face.
Chewing the heads off little kids? Jesus.
Walt shuddered and said,
Is that likely to happen?
We don't believe so. The outsider is aggressive as hell. It was designed to be aggressive after all, and it has a special hatred for its makers, which is something Yarbeck didn't count on, and something she hoped to be able to correct in future generations. The outsider takes great pleasure in slaughtering us. But it's also smart, and it knows that every killing gives us a new fix on its whereabouts. So it's not going to indulge its hatred too often. It's going to stay away from people most of the time, moving mainly at night. Once in a while, out of curiosity, it might poke into residential areas along the edge of the developed eastern flank of the county, as it did at the Kishin place.
Yeah, but I bet it didn't go there to kill anyone, just plain curiosity.
It doesn't want to be caught before it accomplishes its main goal.
Which is?
Finding and killing the dog, Lem said.
Walt was surprised.
Why would it care about the dog?
We don't really know, Lem said. But at Bannadine, it harbored a fierce hatred of the dog, worse than what it felt toward people. When Yarbeck worked with it, constructing a sign language with which to communicate complex ideas, the outsider several times expressed a desire to kill and mutilate the dog. But it would never explain why. It was obsessed with the dog.
So you think now it's tracking the retriever?
Yes.
because evidence seems to indicate that the dog was the first to break out of the labs that night in May, and that its escape drove the outsider mad. The outsider was kept in a large enclosure inside Yarbik's lab, and everything belonging to it, bedding, many educational devices, toys, was torn and smashed to pieces. Then apparently realizing that the dog was going to be forever out of its reach if it didn't make good its own escape, the outsider put its mind to the problem and, by God, found its own way out. But if the dog got a good head start, there's a link between the dog and the outsider that no one understands, a mental link, instinctual awareness. We don't know its extent, but we can't rule out the possibility that this link is strong enough for one of them to follow the other over considerable distances. It's apparently a sort of mild sixth sense that was somehow a bonus of the technique of intelligence enhancement used in both Weatherby's and Yarbek's research. But we're only guessing. We don't really know for sure. There's so fucking much we don't know. Both men were silent for a while. The humid closeness of the car was no longer entirely unpleasant. Given all the dangers loose in the modern world, these steamy confines seemed safe and comfortable. A haven. Finally, not wanting to ask any more questions, afraid of the answers he might get, Walt nevertheless said, "Bannadyne is a high-security building. It's designed to keep unauthorized people from getting in. But it must be hard to get out of the place, too. Yet both the dog and the outsider escaped. This, and obviously no one figured they could. Which means they're both smarter than anyone realized." "Yes," Walt said. "In the case of the dog, well, if it's smarter than anyone figured, so what? The dog is friendly." Lam, who'd been staring at the opaqued windshield, finally met Walt's eyes. "That's right. But if the outsider is smarter than we thought, if it's very nearly as smart as a man, then catching it's going to be even harder." "Very nearly, or as smart as a man." "No. Impossible. Or even smarter," Walt said. "No. That couldn't be." "Couldn't?" "Oh, definitely couldn't." Lem sighed, wearily rubbed his eyes, and said nothing. He was not going to start lying to his best friend again. Part 7. Nora and Travis went through the photographs one by one, learning a little more about Einstein. By barking once or vigorously wagging his tail, the dog answered questions and was able to confirm that he had chosen the advertisements for computers because they reminded him of the computers in the lab where he'd been kept. The photo of four young people playing with a striped beach ball appealed to him because one of the scientists in the lab had evidently used balls of various sizes in an intelligence test that Einstein had particularly enjoyed. They were unable to determine the reason for his interest in the parrot, the butterflies, Mickey Mouse, and many other things, but that was only because they could not hit upon the pertinent yes or no questions that would have led to explanations. Even when 100 questions failed to reveal the meaning of one of the photographs, the three of them remained excited and delighted by the process of discovery, for they met with success in enough cases to make the effort worthwhile. The only time the mood changed for the worse was when they queried Einstein about the magazine picture of the demon from an upcoming horror movie. He became extremely agitated. He tucked his tail between his legs, bared his teeth, growled deep in his throat. Several times he padded away from the photograph, going behind the sofa or into another room, where he stayed for a minute or two before returning, reluctantly, to face additional questions, and he shivered almost continuously when being quizzed about the demon. Finally, after trying for at least 10 minutes to determine the reason for the dog's dread, Travis pointed to the slab-jawed, wickedly fanged, luminous-eyed movie monster and said, "Maybe you don't understand, Einstein. This isn't a picture of a real living thing. This is a make-believe demon from a movie. Do you understand what I mean when I say make-believe?" Einstein wagged his tail. "Yes. Well, this is a make-believe monster." One bark. "No." "Make-believe. Phony. Not real. Just a man in a rubber suit," Nora said. "No." "Yes," Travis said. "No." Einstein tried to run off behind the sofa again, but Travis grabbed him by the collar and held him. "Are you claiming to have seen such a thing?" The dog raised his gaze from the picture,
looked into Travis's eyes, shuddered and whimpered. The pitiful note of profound fear in Einstein's soft whine, and an indescribably disturbing quality in his dark eyes, combined to affect Travis to an extent that surprised him. Holding the collar with one hand, his other hand on Einstein's back, Travis felt the shivers that quaked through the dog, and suddenly he was shivering too. The dog's stark fear was transmitted to him, and he thought crazily, "My God, he really has seen something like this." Sensing the change in Travis, Nora said, "What's wrong?" Instead of answering her, he repeated the question that Einstein had not yet answered. "Are you claiming to have seen such a thing?"
"Yes."
"Something that looks exactly like this demon?"
"A bark and a wag."
"Yes and no."
"Something that looks at least a little bit like it?"
"Yes." Letting go of the collar, Travis stroked the dog's back, trying to soothe him, but Einstein continued to shiver. "Is this why you keep a watch at the window some nights?"
"Yes."
Clearly puzzled and alarmed by the dog's distress, Nora began to pet him too. "I thought you were worried that people from the lab would find you."
Einstein barked once.
"You're not afraid people from the lab will find you?"
"Yes and no."
Travis said, "But you're more afraid that this other thing will find you."
"Yes, yes, yes."
"Is this the same thing that was in the woods that day? The thing that chased us? The thing I shot at?"
Travis asked.
"Yes, yes, yes." Travis looked at Nora. She was frowning. "But it's only a movie monster. Nothing in the real world looks even a little bit like it." Padding across the room, sniffing at the assorted photographs, Einstein paused again at the Blue Cross ad that featured the doctor, mother, and baby in a hospital room. He brought the magazine to them and dropped it on the floor. He put his nose to the doctor in the picture, then looked at Nora, at Travis, put his nose to the doctor again, and looked up expectantly.
"Before," Nora said, "you told us the doctor represented one of the scientists in that lab."
"Yes."
Travis said, "So are you telling me the scientist who worked on you would know what this thing in the woods was?"
"Yes." Einstein went looking through the photographs again, and this time he returned with the ad that showed a car in a cage. He touched his nose to the cage. Then hesitantly, he touched his nose to the picture of the demon.
"Are you saying the thing in the woods belongs in a cage?"
Nora asked.
"Yes."
"More than that," Travis said, "I think he's telling us that it was in a cage at one time, that he saw it in a cage."
"Yes."
"In the same lab where you were in a cage?"
"Yes, yes, yes."
"Another experimental lab animal?" Nora asked.
"Yes."
Travis stared hard at the photograph of the demon, at its thick brow and deeply set yellow eyes, at its deformed snout-like nose and mouth bristling with teeth. At last he said,
"Was it an experiment that went wrong?"
"Yes and no," Einstein said. Now at a peak of agitation, the dog crossed the living room to the front window, jumped up and braced his forepaws on the sill, and peered out at the Santa Barbara evening. Nora and Travis sat on the floor among the opened magazines and books, happy with the progress they had made, beginning to feel the exhaustion that their excitement had masked, and frowning at each other in puzzlement. She spoke softly.
"Do you think Einstein's capable of lying, making up wild stories like children do?"
"I don't know. Can dogs lie? Or is that just a human skill?" He laughed at the absurdity of his own question. "Can dogs lie? Can a moose be elected to the presidency? Can cows sing?"
Nora laughed too, and very prettily.
"Can ducks tap dance?" In a fit of silliness that was a reaction to the difficulty of dealing intellectually and emotionally with the whole idea of a dog as smart as Einstein, Travis said, "I once saw a duck tap dancing."
"Oh yeah?"
"Yeah, in Vegas."
Laughing, she said, "What hotel was he performing at?"
"Caesar's Palace. He could sing too."
"The duck?"
"Yeah. Ask me his name."
"What was his name?"
"Sammy Davis Duck Jr.," Travis said, and they laughed again. "He was such a big star they didn't even have to put his entire name on the marquee for people to know who was performing there."
"They just put Sammy, huh?"
"No, just Junior," Einstein returned from the window and stood watching them, his head cocked, trying to figure out why they were acting so peculiar. The puzzled expression on the retriever's face struck both Travis and Nora as the most comical thing they'd ever seen. They leaned on each other, held each other, and laughed like fools. With a snort of derision, the retriever went back to the window. As they gradually regained control of themselves, as their laughter subsided, Travis became aware that he was holding Nora, that her head was on his shoulder, that the physical contact between them was greater than any they'd allowed themselves before. Her hair smelled clean, fresh. He could feel the body heat pouring off her. Suddenly, he wanted her desperately, and he knew he was going to kiss her when she raised her head from his shoulder. A moment later, she looked up, and he did what he knew he'd do. He kissed her, and she kissed him. For a second or two, she did not seem to realize what was happening, what it meant. Briefly, it was without significance, sweet and utterly innocent, not a kiss of passion, but of friendship and great affection. Then the kiss changed, and her mouth softened. She began to breathe faster, and her hand tightened on his arm, and she tried to pull him closer. A low murmur of need escaped her, and the sound of her own voice brought her to her senses. Abruptly, she stiffened with complete awareness of him as a man, and her beautiful eyes were wide with wonder and fear at what had almost happened. Travis instantly drew back because he knew instinctively that the time was not right, not yet perfect. When at last they did make love, it must be exactly right, without hesitation or distraction, because for the rest of their lives, they would always remember their first time, and the memory should be all bright and joyous, worth taking out and examining 1,000 times as they grew old together. Although it was not quite time to put their future into words and confirm it with vows, Travis had no doubt that he and Nora Devon would be spending their lives with each other. And he realized that subconsciously, he'd been aware of this inevitability for at least the past few days. After a moment of awkwardness, as they drew apart, tried to decide whether to comment on the sudden change in their relationship, Nora finally said, "He's still at the window." Einstein pressed his nose to the glass, staring out at the night. Could he be telling the truth? Nora wondered. Could there have been something else that escaped from the lab? Something that bizarre? If they had a dog as smart as him, I guess they might have had other things even more peculiar. And there was something in the woods that day. But there's no danger of it finding him, surely. Not after you brought him this far north. No danger, Travis agreed. I don't think Einstein understands how far we came from where I found him. Whatever was in the woods couldn't track him down now. But I'll bet the people from the lab have mounted one hell of a search. It's them I'm worried about. And so is Einstein, which is why he usually plays at being a dumb dog in public and reveals his intelligence only in private to me, and now you. He doesn't want to go back. Nora said, if they find him, they won't. But if they do, what then? I'll never give him up, Travis said. Never. Part 8. By 11 o'clock that night, Deputy Porter's headless corpse and the mutilated body of the construction foreman had been removed from Bordeaux Ridge by the coroner's men. A cover story had been concocted and delivered to the reporters at the police barricades, and the press had seemed to buy it. They had asked their questions, had taken a couple of 100 photographs, and had filled a few 1,000 feet of videotape with images that would be edited down to 100 seconds on tomorrow's TV newscast. In this age of mass murder and terrorism, 2 victims rated no more than 2 minutes airtime. 10 seconds for lead-in, 100 seconds for film, 10 seconds for the well-coiffed anchor persons to look respectfully grim and saddened, then on to a story about a bikini contest, a convention of Edsel owners, or a man who claimed to have seen an alien spacecraft shaped like a Twinkie. The reporters were gone now, as were the lab men, the uniformed deputies, and all of Lemuel Johnson's agents except Cliff Soames. Clouds hid the fragment moon. The colleagues were gone, and the only light came from the headlamps of Walt Gaines' car.
He had swung his sedan around and aimed his lights at Lem's car, which was parked at the end of the unpaved street, so Lem and Cliff would not have to fumble around in the dark. In the deep gloom beyond the headlamps, half-framed houses loomed like the fossilized skeletons of prehistoric reptiles. As he walked toward his car, Lem felt as good as he could feel under the circumstances. Walt had agreed to allow federal authorities to assume jurisdiction without a challenge. Although Lem had broken a dozen regulations and had violated his secrecy oath by telling Walt the details of the Francis Project, he was sure Walt could keep his mouth shut. The lid was still on the case, a bit looser than it had been, perhaps, but still in place. Cliff Soames reached the car first, opened the door, and got in on the passenger's side. And as Lem opened the driver's door, he heard Cliff say, "Oh, Jesus! Oh, God!" Cliff was scrambling back out of the car even as Lem looked in from the other side and saw what the uproar was about. A head. Teal Porter's head, no doubt. It was on the front seat of the car, propped so it was facing Lem when he opened the door. The mouth hung open in a silent scream. The eyes were gone. Reeling back from the car, Lem reached under his coat and pulled his revolver. Walt Gaines was already out of his car, his own revolver in hand, running toward Lem. "What's wrong?" Lem pointed. Reaching the NSA sedan, Walt looked through the open door and let out a thin, anguished sound when he saw the head. Cliff came around from the other side of the car, gripping his gun with the muzzle pointed straight up. "The damn thing was here when we arrived, while we were in the house." "Might still be here," Lem said, anxiously surveying the darkness that crowded them on all sides, beyond the beams from the patrol car's headlights. Studying the night-swaddled housing development, Walt said, "We'll call in my men. Get a search underway." "No point to it," Lem said. "This thing will take off if it sees your men returning, if it's not gone already." They were standing at the edge of Bordeaux Ridge, beyond which lay miles of open land, foothills and mountains, out of which the outsider had come, and into which he could disappear again. Those hills, ridges, and canyons were only vague forms in the meager glow of the partial moon, more sensed than seen. From somewhere down the unlighted street came a loud clatter, as if a pile of lumber or shingles had been knocked over.
"It is here," Walt said.
"Maybe," Lem said, "but we're not going to go looking for it in the dark, not just the three of us. That's what it wants." They listened. Nothing more.
"We searched the whole tract when we first got here, before you arrived," Walt said.
Cliff said, "It must have kept one step ahead of you, making a game of dodging your men. Then it saw us arrive and it recognized Lem."
"Recognized me from the couple of times I visited Bannadyne," Lem agreed.
"In fact, the outsider was probably waiting here just for me. It probably understands my role in all this, and knows I'm in charge of the search for it and the dog. So it wanted to leave the deputy's head for me."
"To mock you?" Walt said.
"To mock me." They were silent, peering uneasily at the blackness within and around the unfinished houses. The hot June air was motionless. For a long while, the only sound was the idling engine of the sheriff's car.
"Watching us," Walt said.
Another clatter of overturned construction materials. Nearer, this time. The three men froze, each looking a different direction, guarding against attack. The subsequent silence lasted almost a minute. When Lem was about to speak, the outsider shrieked. The cry was alien, chilling. This time they could identify the direction from which it came, out in the open land, in the night beyond Bordeaux Ridge.
"It's leaving now," Lem said.
"It's decided we can't be lured into a search, just the three of us. So it's leaving before we can bring in reinforcements." It shrieked again, from farther away. The eerie cry was like sharp fingernails raked across Lem's soul.
"In the morning," he said, "we'll move our marine intelligence teams into the foothills east of here. We'll nail the damn thing. By God, we will."
Turning to Lem's sedan, evidently contemplating the unpleasant task of dealing with Teal Porter's severed head, Walt said,
"Why the eyes? Why does it always tear out the eyes?"
Lem said, "Partly because the creature's just damned aggressive, bloodthirsty. That's in its genes. And partly because it really enjoys spreading terror, I think."
but also...
What?
I wish I didn't remember this, but I do very clearly. On one of his visits to Bannadyne, Lem had witnessed a disturbing conversation, of sorts, between Dr. Yarbeck and the Outsider. Yarbeck and her assistants had taught the Outsider a sign language, similar to that developed by the researchers who attempted the first experiments in communication with the higher primates, like gorillas, back in the mid-1970s. The most successful gorilla subject, a female named Coco, which had been the center of countless news stories over the past decade, was reputed to have attained a sign language vocabulary of approximately 400 words. When Lem had last seen it, the Outsider boasted a vocabulary considerably larger than Coco's, though still primitive. In Yarbeck's lab, Lem had watched as the man-made monstrosity in the large cage had exchanged complicated series of hand signals with the scientist, while an assistant had whispered a running translation. The Outsider had expressed a fierce hostility toward everyone and everything, frequently interrupting its dialogue with Yarbeck to dash around its cage in uncontrolled rage, banging on the iron bars, screeching furiously. To Lem, the scene was frightening and repellent, but he was also filled with a terrible sadness and pity at the plight of the Outsider. The beast would always be caged, always a freak, alone in the world as no other creature, not even Weatherby's dog, had ever been. The experience had affected him so deeply that he still remembered nearly every exchange of sign language between the Outsider and Yarbeck. And now a pertinent part of that eerie conversation came back to him. At one point the Outsider had signed, "Tear out your eyes!" "You want to tear out my eyes?" Yarbeck signed. "Tear out everyone's eyes!" "Why?" "So can't see me." "Why don't you want to be seen?"
"Ugly."
"You think you're ugly?"
"Much ugly."
"Where did you get the idea you're ugly?"
"From people."
"What people?"
"Everyone who see me first time."
"Like this man with us today?" Yarbeck signed, indicating Lem.
"Yes, all think me ugly, hate me."
"No one hates you."
"Everyone."
"No one's ever told you that you're ugly. How do you know that's what they think?"
"I know."
"How do you know?"
"I know, I know, I know."
It raced around its cage, rattling the bars, shrieking, and then it returned to face Yarbeck.
"Tear out my own eyes."
"So you won't have to look at yourself?"
"So won't have to look at people looking at me,"
the creature had signed. And Lem had pitied it then, deeply, though his pity had in no way diminished his fear of it. Now, standing in the hot June night, he told Walt Gaines about that exchange in Yarbeck's lab, and the sheriff shivered.
"Jesus," Cliff Soames said. "It hates itself, its otherness, and so it hates its maker even more."
"And now that you've told me this," Walt said, "I'm surprised none of you ever understood why it hates the dog so passionately. This poor damn twisted thing and the dog are essentially the only two children of the Francis Project. The dog is the beloved child, the favored child, and the Outsider has always known that. The dog is the child that the parents want to brag about, while the Outsider is the child they'd prefer to keep locked securely in a cellar. And so it resents the dog, stews in resentment every minute of every day."
"Of course," Lem said. "You're right, of course. It also gives new meaning to the two smashed mirrors in the upstairs bathrooms in the house where Teal Porter was killed," Walt said. "The thing couldn't bear the sight of itself."
In the distance, very far away now, something shrieked. Something that was not of God's creation. Chapter 7 Part 1 During the rest of June, Nora did some painting, spent a lot of time with Travis, and tried to teach Einstein to read. Neither she nor Travis was sure that the dog, although very smart, could be taught such a thing, but it was worth a try. If he understood spoken English, as seemed to be the case, then it followed that he could be taught the printed word as well. Of course, they could not be absolutely certain that Einstein did understand spoken English, even though he responded to it with apt and specific reactions. It was remotely possible that instead, the dog did not perceive the precise meanings of the words themselves, but by some mild form of telepathy,
could read the word pictures in people's minds as they spoke. "But I don't believe that's the case," Travis said one afternoon as he and Nora sat on his patio, drinking wine coolers and watching Einstein frolic in the spray of a portable lawn sprinkler. "Maybe because I don't want to believe it. The idea that he's both as smart as me and telepathic is just too much. If that's the case, then maybe I should be wearing the collar and he should be holding the leash." It was a Spanish test that appeared to indicate the retriever was not, in fact, even slightly telepathic. In college, Travis had taken 3 years of Spanish. Later, upon choosing a career in the military and signing on with the elite Delta Force, he'd been encouraged to continue those language studies because his superiors believed the escalating political instability in Central and South America guaranteed that Delta would be required to conduct anti-terrorist operations in Spanish-speaking countries with steadily increasing frequency. He had been out of Delta for many years, but contact with a large population of California Hispanics had kept him relatively fluent. Now when he gave Einstein orders or asked questions in Spanish, the dog stared at him stupidly, wagging his tail, unresponsive. When Travis persisted in Spanish, the retriever cocked his head and woofed, as if to inquire if this was a joke. Surely if the dog was reading mental images that arose in the mind of the speaker, he would be able to read them regardless of the language that inspired those images. "He's no mind reader," Travis said. "There are limits to his genius, thank God." Day after day, Nora sat on the floor of Travis's living room or on the patio, explaining the alphabet to Einstein and trying to help him to understand how words were formed from those letters and how those printed words were related to the spoken words that he had already understood. Now and then, Travis took charge of the lessons to give Nora a break, but most of the time he sat nearby reading because he claimed not to have the patience to be a teacher. She used a ring binder notebook to compile her own primer for the dog. On each left-hand page, she taped a picture cut from a magazine, and on each right-hand page she printed in block letters the name of the object that was pictured on the left, all simple words: tree, car, house, man, woman, chair. With Einstein sitting beside her and staring intently at the primer, she would point to the picture first, then to the word, pronouncing it repeatedly. On the last day of June, Nora spread a score or more of unlabeled pictures on the floor. "It's test time again," she told Einstein. "Let's see if you can do better than you did on Monday." Einstein sat very erect, his chest puffed out, his head held high, as if confident of his ability. Travis was sitting in the armchair watching. He said, "If you fail for a face, we're going to trade you in on a poodle that can roll over, play dead, and beg for its supper." Nora was pleased to see that Einstein ignored Travis. "This is not a time for frivolity," she admonished. "I stand corrected, Professor," Travis said. Nora held up a flashcard with "tree" printed on it. The retriever went unerringly to the photo of a pine tree and indicated it with a touch of his nose. When she held up a card that said "car," he put a paw on the photo of the car. And when she held up "house," he sniffed at the picture of a colonial mansion. They went through 50 words, and for the first time the dog correctly paired every printed word with the image it represented. Nora was thrilled by his progress, and Einstein could not stop wagging his tail. Travis said, "Well, Einstein, you're still a hell of a long way from reading Proust." Rankled by Travis's needling of her star pupil, Nora said, "He's doing fine. Terrific. You can't expect him to be reading at college level overnight. He's learning faster than child would."
"Is that so?"
"Yes, that's so. Much faster than a child would." "Well, then, maybe he deserves a couple of milk bones." Einstein dashed immediately into the kitchen to get the box of dog biscuits. Part 2. As the summer wore on, Travis was amazed by the swift progress Nora made in teaching Einstein to read. By the middle of July, they graduated from her homemade primer to children's picture books by Dr. Seuss, Maurice Sendak, Phil Parks, Susie Bodel, Sue Dreamer, Mercer Mayer, and many others. Einstein appeared to enjoy all of them immensely, though his favorites were by Parks, and especially, for reasons neither Nora nor Travis could discern, the charming Frog and Toad books by Arnold Lobel. They brought arms full of children's books home from the city library, and purchased additional stacks of them at the bookstore. At first, Nora read them aloud, carefully moving a finger under each word as she spoke it, and Einstein's eyes followed along as he leaned in toward the book with undivided attention. Later, she did not read the book aloud, but held it open for the dog and turned the pages for him when he indicated, by a whimper or some other sign, that he had finished that portion of the text and was ready to proceed to the next page. Einstein's willingness to sit for hours, focusing on the books, seemed proof that he was actually reading them, and not just looking at the cute drawings. Nevertheless, Nora decided to test him on the contents of some of the volumes by posing a number of questions about the storylines. After Einstein had read Frog and Toad All Year, Nora closed the book and said, "All right, now, answer yes or no to these questions." They were in the kitchen, where Travis was making a cheese and potato casserole for dinner. Nora and Einstein were sitting on chairs at the kitchen table. Travis paused in his cooking to watch the dog take the quiz. Nora said, "First, when Frog came to see Toad on a winter's day, Toad was in bed and did not want to come outside. Is that right?" Einstein had to sidle around on his chair to free his tail and wag it. "Yes," Nora said. "But finally Frog got Toad outside and they went ice skating." One bark. "No." "They went sledding," she said. "Yes." "Very good. Later that same year at Christmas, Frog gave Toad a gift." "Was it a sweater?" "No." "A new sled?" "No." "A clock for his mantle?" "Yes, yes, yes." "Excellent," Nora said. "Now, what should we read next? How about this one? Fantastic Mr. Fox." Einstein wagged his tail vigorously. Travis would have enjoyed taking a more active role in the dog's education, but he could see that working intensely with Einstein was having an enormously beneficial effect on Nora, and he did not want to interfere. Indeed, he sometimes played the curmudgeon, questioning the value of teaching the pooch to read, making wisecracks about the pace of the dog's progress or its taste in reading matter. This mild naysaying was just enough to redouble Nora's determination to stick with the lessons, to spend even more time with the dog, and to prove Travis wrong. Einstein never reacted to those negative remarks, and Travis suspected the dog exhibited forbearance because he understood the little game of reverse psychology in which Travis was engaged. Exactly why Nora's teaching chores made her blossom was not clear. Perhaps it was because she had never interacted with anyone, not even with Travis or with her Aunt Violet, as intensely as she had with the dog. And the mere process of extensive communication encouraged her to come further out of her shell. Or perhaps giving the gift of literacy to the dog was extremely satisfying to her. She was by nature a giving person, who took pleasure in sharing with others. Yet she had spent all of her life as a recluse, without a single previous opportunity to express that side of her personality. Now she had a chance to give of herself, and she was generous with her time and energy, and in her own generosity, she found joy. Travis also suspected that through her relationship with the retriever, she was expressing a natural talent for mothering. Her great patience was that of a good mother dealing with a child, and she often spoke to Einstein so tenderly and affectionately that she sounded as if she were addressing her own much-loved offspring. Whatever the reason, Nora became more relaxed and outgoing as she worked with Einstein, gradually forsaking her shapeless dark dresses for summery white cotton slacks, colorful blouses, jeans and t-shirts. She seemed to grow 10 years younger. She had her glorious dark hair redone at the beauty salon, and did not brush out all the styling this time. She laughed more often and more engagingly. In conversation, she met Travis's eyes and seldom looked shyly away from him, as she had done previously. She was quicker to touch him, too, to put an arm around his waist. She liked to be hugged, and they kissed with ease now, although their kissing remained, for the most part, that of uncertain teenagers in the early stages of courting. On July 14th, Nora received news that lifted her spirits even higher. The Santa Barbara District Attorney's Office called to tell her that it was not going to be necessary for her to appear in court to testify against Arthur Streck. In light of his previous criminal record, Streck had changed his mind about pursuing a plea of innocence and waging a defense against charges of attempted rape, assault, and breaking and entering. He had instructed his attorney to plea bargain with the DA. As a result, they dropped all charges except assault, and Streck accepted a prison sentence of 3 years, with a provision that he serve at least 2 years before being eligible for parole. Nora had dreaded the trial. Suddenly, she was free, and in celebration, she got slightly tipsy for the first time in her life. That same day, when Travis brought home a new stack of reading material, Einstein discovered there were Mickey Mouse picture books for children and comic books, and the dog was as jubilant about that discovery as Nora was about the resolution of the charges against Arthur Streck. His fascination with Mickey and Donald Duck and the rest of the Disney gang remained a mystery, but it was undeniable. Einstein couldn't stop wagging his tail, and he slobbered all over Travis in gratitude. Everything would have been rosy if, in the middle of the night, Einstein had stopped going through the house from window to window, looking out at the darkness with obvious fear. Part 3. By Thursday morning, July 15th, almost 6 weeks after the murders at Bordeaux Ridge, 2 months after the dog and the outsider had escaped from Banodyne, Lemuel Johnson sat alone in his office on an upper floor of the federal building in Santa Ana, the county seat of Orange County. He stared out the window at the pollutant-rich haze that was trapped under an inversion layer, blanketing the western half of the country and adding to the misery of 100-degree heat. The bile yellow day matched his sour mood. His duties were not limited to the search for the lab escapees, but that case constantly worried him when he was doing other work. He was unable to put the Banodyne affair out of mind, even to sleep, and lately he was averaging only 4 or 5 hours of rest a night. He could not tolerate failure. Now, in truth, his attitude was much stronger than that. He was obsessed with avoiding failure. His father, having started life dirt poor, and having built a successful business, had inculcated in Lem an almost religious belief in the need to achieve, to succeed, and to fulfill all of one's goals. No matter how much success you had, his dad often said, life could pull the rug right out from under you if you weren't diligent. It's even worse for a black man, Lem. With a black man, success is like a tightrope over the Grand Canyon. He's up there real high, and it's sweet, but when he makes a mistake, when he fails, it's a mile-long drop into an abyss. An abyss. Because failure means being poor. And in a lot of people's eyes, even in this enlightened age, a poor, miserable, failed black man is no man at all. He's just a nigger. That was the only time his father ever used the hated word. Lem had grown up with the conviction that any success he achieved was merely a precarious toehold on the cliff of life. That he was always in danger of being blown off that cliff by the winds of adversity, and that he dared not relent in his determination to cling fast and to climb to a wider, safer ledge. He wasn't sleeping well, and his appetite was no good. When he did eat, the meal was inevitably followed by severe acid indigestion. His bridge game had gone to hell because he could not concentrate on the cards. At their weekly get-togethers with Walt and Audrey Gaines, the Johnsons were taking a beating. He knew why he was obsessed with closing every case successfully, but that knowledge was of no help in modifying his obsession. We are what we are, he thought, and maybe the only time we can change what we are is when life throws us such a surprise that it's like hitting a plate glass window with a baseball bat, shattering the grip of the past. So he stared out at the blazing July day and brooded, worried. Back in May, he had surmised that the retriever might have been picked up by someone and given a home. It was, after all, a handsome animal, and if it revealed even a small fraction of its intelligence to anyone, its appeal would be irresistible. It would find sanctuary. Therefore, Lem figured locating the dog would be harder than tracking down the outsider. A week to locate the outsider, he had thought, and perhaps a month to lay hands on the retriever. He had issued bulletins to every animal pound and veterinarian in California, Nevada, and Arizona, urgently requesting assistance in locating the golden retriever. The flyer claimed that the animal had escaped from a medical research lab that was conducting an important cancer experiment. The loss of the dog, the bulletin claimed, would mean the loss of $1 million of research money and countless hours of researchers' time, and might seriously impede the development of a cure for certain malignancies. The flyer included a photograph of the dog and information that, on the inside of its left ear, it bore a lab tattoo, the number 33-9. The letter accompanying the flyer requested not only cooperation, but confidentiality. The mailing had been repeated every 7 days since the breakout at Bannodyne, and a score of NSA agents had been doing nothing but phoning animal pounds and vets in the 3 states to be certain they remembered the flyer and continued to keep a lookout for a retriever with the tattoo. Meanwhile, the urgent search for the outsider could, with some confidence, be confined to undeveloped territories, because it would be reluctant to show itself, and there was no chance that someone would think it was cute enough to take home. Besides, the outsider had been leaving a trail of death that could be followed. Subsequent to the murders at Bordeaux Ridge, east of Yorba Linda, the creature had fled into the unpopulated Chino Hills. From there it had gone north, crossing into the eastern end of Los Angeles County, where its presence was next pinpointed on June 9th on the outskirts of semi-rural Diamond Bar. The Los Angeles County Animal Control Authority had received numerous and hysterical reports from Diamond Bar residents regarding wild animal attacks on domestic pets. Others called the police, believing the slaughter was the work of a deranged man. In 2 nights, more than a score of Diamond Bar's domestic animals had been torn to pieces, and the condition of the carcasses left no doubt in Lem's mind that the perpetrator was the outsider. Then the trail went ice cold for more than a week, until the morning of June 18th, when 2 young campers at the foot of Johnstone Peak, on the southern flank of the vast Angeles National Forest, reported seeing something they insisted was from another world. They had locked themselves in their van, but the creature had tried repeatedly to get in at them, going so far as to smash a side window with a rock. Fortunately, the pair kept a .32 pistol in the van, and one of them opened fire on their assailant, driving it off. The press treated the campers as a couple of kooks, and on the evening news, the Happy Talk anchor persons got a lot of mileage out of the story. Lem believed the young couple. On a map, he traced the thinly populated corridor of land by which the outsider could have gone from Diamond Bar to the area below Johnstone Peak. Over the San Jose Hills, through Bonelli Regional Park, between San Dimas and Glendora, then into the wilds. It would have had to cross or go under 3 freeways that cut through the area. But if it had traveled in the deep of night, when there was little or no traffic, it could have passed unseen. He shifted the 100 men from Marine Intelligence into that portion of the forest, where they continued their search in civilian dress in groups of 3 and 4. He hoped the campers had hit the outsider with at least 1 shot, but no blood was found at their campsite. He was beginning to worry that the outsider might evade capture for a long time. Lying north of the city of Los Angeles, the Angeles National Forest was discouragingly immense. "Nearly as large as the entire state of Delaware," Cliff Soames said, after he had measured the area on the wall map pinned to the bulletin board in Lem's office and had calculated the square miles. Cliff had come from Delaware. He was relatively new to the West, and still had a newcomer's amazement at the gigantic scale of everything at this end of the continent. He was also young, with the enthusiasm of youth, and he was almost dangerously optimistic. Cliff's upbringing had been radically different from Lem's, and he did not feel himself to be on a tightrope or at risk of having his life destroyed by just one error, by a single failure. Sometimes Lem envied him. Lem stared at Cliff's scribbled calculations. "If it takes refuge in the San Gabriel Mountains, feeding on wildlife and content with solitude, venturing out only rarely to vent its rage on the people living along the periphery of the preserve, it might never be found. But remember," Cliff said, "it hates the dog more than it hates men. It wants the dog and has the ability to find it." "So we think. And could it really tolerate a wild existence? I mean, yeah, it's part savage, but it's also smart. Maybe too smart to be content with a hardscrabble life in that rugged country." "Maybe," Lem said. "They'll spot it soon, or it'll do something to give us another fix on it. Cliff predicted. That was June 18th. When they found no trace of the outsider during the next 10 days, the expense of keeping 100 men in the field grew insupportable. On June 29th, Lem finally had to relinquish the Marines that had been put at his disposal and send them back to their bases. Day by day, Cliff was heartened by the lack of developments and was willing to believe that the outsider had suffered a mishap, that it was dead, that they would never hear of it again. Day by day, Lem sank deeper into gloom, certain that he had lost control of the situation, and that the outsider would reappear in a most dramatic fashion, making its existence known to the public. Failure. The only bright spot was that the beast was now in Los Angeles County, out of Walt Gaines's jurisdiction. If there were additional victims, Walt might not even learn of them, and would not have to be persuaded all over again to remain out of the case. By Thursday, July 15th, exactly 2 months after the breakout at Bannadyne, almost 1 month after the campers had been terrorized by a supposed extraterrestrial or smaller cousin of Bigfoot, Lem was convinced he would soon have to consider alternate careers. No one had blamed him for the way things had gone. The heat was on him to deliver, but it was no worse than the heat he had felt on other big investigations. Actually, some of his superiors viewed the lack of developments in the same favorable light as did Cliff Soames. But in his most pessimistic moments, Lem envisioned himself employed as a uniformed security guard working the night shift in a warehouse, demoted to the status of a make-believe cop with a rinky-dink badge. Sitting in his office chair, facing the window, staring grimly at the hazy yellow air of the blazing summer day, he said aloud, "Damn it! I've been trained to deal with human criminals. How the hell can I be expected to outthink a fugitive from a nightmare?" A knock sounded at his door, and as he swiveled around in his chair, the door opened. Cliff Soames entered in a rush, looking both excited and distraught. "The outsider," he said. "We've got a new fix on it. But 2 people are dead." 20 years ago in Vietnam, Lem's NSA chopper pilot had learned everything worth knowing about putting down and taking off in rugged terrain. Now, remaining in constant radio contact with the LA County Sheriff's deputies who were on the scene already, he had no difficulty locating the site of the murders by visual navigation, making use of natural landmarks. At a few minutes after 1 o'clock, he put his craft down on a wide section of a barren ridge overlooking Boulder Canyon in the Angeles National Forest, just 100 yards from the spot where the bodies had been found. When Lem and Cliff left the chopper and hurried along the crest of the ridge toward the gathered deputies and forest rangers, a hot wind buffeted them. It carried the scent of dry brush and pine. Only tufts of wild grass, parched and brittled by the July sun, had managed to put down roots on this high ground. Low scrub growth, including desert plants like mesquite, marked the upper reaches of the canyon walls that dropped away to the right and left of them, and down on the lower slopes and canyon floors were trees and greener undergrowth. They were less than 4 air miles north of the town of Sunland, 14 air miles north of Hollywood, and 20 miles north of the populous heart of the great city of Los Angeles. Yet it seemed they were in a desolation measuring 1,000 miles across, disquietingly far from civilization. The sheriff's deputies had parked their 4-wheel drive wagons on a crude dirt track, 3/4 of a mile away. Coming in, Lem's chopper had flown over those vehicles, and they had hiked with ranger guides to the site where the bodies had been found. Now gathered around the corpses were 4 deputies, 2 men from the county crime lab, and 3 rangers, and they looked as if they, too, felt isolated in a primeval place. When Lem and Cliff arrived, the sheriff's men had just finished tucking the remains in body bags. The zippers hadn't yet been closed, so Lem saw that 1 victim was male, the other female, both young and dressed for hiking. Their wounds were grievous. Their eyes were gone. The dead now numbered 5 innocents, and that toll conjured a specter of guilt that haunted Lem. At times like this, he wished that his father had raised him with no sense of responsibility whatsoever. Deputy Hal Bochner, tall and tan, but with a surprisingly reedy voice, apprised Lem of the identity and condition of the victims. "Based on the ID he was carrying, the male's name was Sidney Trankin,
28 of Glendale. Body has more than a score of nasty bite marks, even more claw marks, slashes. Throat, as you saw, torn open. Eyes?
Yes, Lem said, seeing no need to dwell on these grisly details.